confined within the walls of a South African jail. The young lawyer from India found no reason to complain.
Some say that jail is a palace. Others look upon it as a beautiful garden. Some others hold that through the jail gates, we shall pass from our present bondage to freedom.
The year was 1907. The young lawyer from India was Mohandas Gandhi. Gandhi led his fellow Indians in a non-violent struggle against racial oppression for 8 years. They marched into forbidden territory. They burned their registration papers. They expected to be arrested, and they were not disappointed. Gandhi said, "Non-violent refusal to cooperate with injustice is the way to defeat it." J.C. Smuts, the Interior Minister, tells Gandhi, "You reduce me to helplessness. How can we lay hands on you without looking like villains?" He became known for his ability to mobilize people and for his increasingly simple way of life. He gave his non-violent weapon a name, Satyagraha, holding to truth. In every decade and on every continent, underdogs have taken up Gandhi's strategies to fight for their rights and freedom.
Nonviolence means fighting back, but you're fighting back with other weapons.
The power that Gandhi discovered changed the 20th century.
Major funding for this series was provided by Susan and Perry Lerner. Additional funding was provided by the Albert Einstein Institution, advancing the study of strategic nonviolent action in conflicts throughout the world. Elizabeth and John H. Van Merkenstein III, Abby and Alan Levy, and the Arthur Vining Davis Foundations.
Sixty years after Gandhi's struggle in South Africa, his ideas found new followers in the American South.
Students at Fisk University, a leading black institution, can ignore segregation on campus, but when they venture downtown, many are shocked by the southern system.
I grew up on the south side of Chicago, and although I experienced segregation there, it was not the overt kind where there were signs on water fountains and on restrooms. It was humiliating.
Well, Nashville was a totally segregated city. It was as segregated as Johannesburg, the height of apartheid. It was a city of two races. There was virtually no contact between the white community and the black community. In school, in neighborhoods, in jobs, in church, Nashville was a totally and completely segregated city, and for the most part, totally satisfied and happy with that.
Students at American Baptist College in eastern Nashville know that segregation is being challenged, that some are working against the violent repression, even lynchings that enforce it. They want to join the struggle.
We've been taught one thing in the school about the Declaration of Independence, about the Bill of Rights, about the Constitution. And then in the real world, we were living something else.
James Lawson, a Methodist minister from Ohio, soon gives Nashville's students
a chance to take part. The soft-spoken Lawson is 30 and has spent 3 years teaching in India, where he studied the work of Mohandas Gandhi. In a small church near the Fisk campus, Lawson has started a series of evening workshops on nonviolent action.
Now tonight we have a most important business to try to accomplish.
Jim Lawson's manner is cool. His objective is breathtaking: to eliminate segregation. His classes attract Nashville's brightest students.
A good friend of mine in Alabama here last April was taken out by the KKK and beaten on a tree, tied to a tree, beaten by chains and whatnot.
I thought nonviolence would not work. But I stayed with the workshops for one reason, and that is because they were the only game in town. That was the only group even trying to do anything to combat segregation that I knew about.
He started praying, "Father, forgive these men."
Jim Lawson has been encouraged to come south by Martin Luther King Jr., who says the civil rights movement needs leaders who understand nonviolent strategy and tactics.
Then they started protesting. "You can't pray that prayer," they said. And then others said, "Yes, but the man who's going to die has a right to pray any way he wants to pray." And this immediately started a division among them.
We took the whole group through a holistic view of nonviolence, its history, its roots in the Bible, its roots in Christian thought. The methods of nonviolence. We told the stories of nonviolence. And I stressed the Gandhian idea of our being engaged in experiment.
It may have much more meaning to the attacker if, as he strikes you on the cheek, you're looking him in the eyes.
Unfortunately, the concept of nonviolence for many people is that you get hit on one cheek, you turn the other cheek, you don't do anything. But nonviolence means fighting back. But you're fighting back with another purpose and with other weapons. Number one, your fight is to win that person over. And that is a fight. That's a struggle. That's much more challenging than fist to cuffs.
Right. Okay. Peggy?
Jim, if I were being beaten, what is it that I would be able to do?
We said we were going to desegregate downtown Nashville. Our first step was going to be desegregate lunch counters and restaurants. That, of course, was the first Gandhian step. That was the first step of nonviolence, to research and examine and focus on an issue. Choose a target, choose an issue.
Now, let's see.
Months before going to the lunchrooms, Lawson begins preparing them.
"A bunch of niggers. Well, look at the eight balls all lined up.
Hi there, Jungle Bunny.
He's so dark, he's making the whole place dark.
He wants them to have experienced both physical and verbal attacks and to learn how to resist the impulse to run or fight back.
Now let's see what we've learned from this to us as to how we might act nonviolently. What are the basic problems here so far?
You cannot go on a demonstration with 25 people doing whatever they want to do. They have to have a common discipline. And that's a key word for me, that the difficulty with nonviolent people and efforts is that they don't recognize the necessity of fierce discipline and training and strategizing and planning and recruiting and doing the kinds of things that you do to have a movement. That can't happen spontaneously. It has to be done systematically.
They stage their first sit-in on a Saturday when they are sure to be noticed.
We spent many, many hours anticipating some of the opposition. And we knew that that's one of the things that they would say. We don't want to sit next to dirty people while we have lunch. And so one of the ways we combated that was by having a dress code.
We had been told it was a possibility of being arrested. But we went to the lunch counter. We took our seats. We sat, and we sat in a very orderly, peaceful fashion.
They are not surprised when they are refused service.
I said, I'm sorry, our management does not allow us to serve niggers in here.
Store managers quickly close the dining areas, but the students remain until closing time, reading and doing homework. There is no violence, and no one is arrested. The sit-ins make page 10 of the Sunday paper. City editor John Siegenthaler remembers the reaction.
The reaction initially was sort of shock and maybe even some humor. I mean, who do they think they are? What do they think they're doing? We knew it was a news story, but didn't really know how to cover it.
Local businesses take a predictable position. They'll close down before they'll serve black customers. A week later, the students are back. They provoke curiosity and verbal abuse, but no arrests. Whites still think the sit-ins are a passing fad, hardly a threat to the status quo. On the third Saturday, they are ready to target a total of six stores.
Let each person now get himself or herself a partner that they will stick with. Now, we don't want a white person with a Negro of the opposite sex, because we don't want to fight that battle.
We were told in advance that day that they were going to allow the hoodlums to beat us up, and then the policemen were going to arrest us. So we need to be prepared to get beaten and arrested. So that was a condition under which we went down.
Oh, Master, you're not in a single group, are you? Will you go to this Woolworth group?
We tried to be certain that our strongest and best leaders were leading each group that went in. We also had fairly disciplined groups go into each of the places that we decided to sit in on that Saturday. We decided that we'd have a second group ready for each store. Initially that morning, we had some 600 people ready to be arrested, in fact.
By now, they're well prepared for contingencies. Each group includes a leader and observers who will phone reports back to the church. Observers are carrying telephone numbers for ambulance services and a pocket full of telephone change. As they enter the stores, the second and third waves of demonstrators stay out of sight, ready to move in when the first group is arrested. As predicted, the police hang back for the first 15 minutes.
And asked each and every one of them separately to leave. They didn't leave, so I instructed the men to place them under arrest. We placed them under arrest. When we cleared the stools, some more colored boys and girls and white boys and girls got on the seats.
It really surprised the police. They thought they had lowered the boom. And when they turned around and looked and saw a lunch counter, once again, full of Negro students, you could just see that they kind of looked at each other out of the corners of their eyes as though, do you see this? What will we do now? And there was still another group ready to take their places.
We felt so proud and so happy that the things that we had been taught in these workshops, the thing that we have learned, the role playing, the social drama that we had gone through, it was now we had to live it. And in a sense, I think we failed to convince ourselves that we had passed the test.
Union Jail.
Oh. I'm joking.
Man, what's my mother gonna say when she hear about that?
We had a philosophy, which was a power of nonviolence. And that kind of power we felt was more forceful than all of their police force, all of their lawmakers, and all of their dogs or billy clubs or jails, and that our capacity and willingness to suffer outweighed any power they had.
Mass arrests are a victory for the students. Reporters realize they are covering a story of national significance.
I mean, it was like being a war correspondent in your own hometown. The only thing you knew was that the war was on, that the weapon of nonviolence was winning over violence, and that this was a historic moment, however it came out. I think there was a sense of history there that we all understood.
At police headquarters on Monday morning, the students are still behind bars. On principle, they have refused bail. In just 48 hours, their small student movement has inspired thousands. Now the city's black community has joined in the struggle, organizing, raising money, recruiting lawyers. Alexander Luby is among Nashville's most prominent black lawyers, and he has organized local lawyers to defend the arrested students. As they come before a judge, their arrests, like Gandhi's, have dramatized their grievances.
In the African American community, there was a great sense of righteous indignation. People couldn't believe that these young, well-dressed, innocent college students are being arrested and put in jail. They didn't like it. And the city, African-American population was mobilized in such a fashion, and the movement spread through the city of Nashville like wildfire.
As the crowds wait to see what the city will do, the mayor speaks to reporters.
Anyone violating the law will be arrested. This must be so.
By emphasizing law and order, the mayor takes sides with the store owners. In fact, the arrested students have broken no law, and none of the white attackers has been arrested.
The city and police were ill-prepared for a mass civil disobedience effort. They had anticipated that once the violence took place and the arrests began, our movement would dissipate, would be chased away, because that's the purpose, after all, of doing the violence, and it's the purpose of doing the arresting. It's hopeful that then whatever this is will vanish, and that's the end of it. That didn't happen.
A week later, nothing has changed. As the students return to the lunch counters, the city has only one answer: more arrests. On trial for disorderly conduct, they face a choice: a $50 fine or 30 days in the county workhouse. Refusing to pay fines to support a system which oppresses them, they opt for the workhouse.
We had overloaded the jail. They didn't have enough, you know, food or supplies and stuff like that. A lot of people had to work overtime, you know, and so it was a burden on the system. But that's what we intended.
Now in the national spotlight, the movement is deluged with new recruits. Jim Lawson's workshops expand to meet the demand. Nashville's churches provide meeting space, telephones, mimeograph machines. Now they must get the message out, far beyond Nashville.
We were not simply addressing our immediate opponents. What we were doing was addressing the larger audience, the nation, the world. Because the strategy in nonviolence is that you educate a large number of constituents and win them, on your side. In fact, even though we as African Americans were a minority, no change could take place unless you have the sympathy of the majority, if not the active participation.
The students know that sympathy by itself may not be enough. Taking advantage of the outrage their arrests have provoked, they escalate the conflict. Sit-ins continue, but a new tactic is added: a boycott of the downtown shopping district. Picketers ask customers not to patronize stores whose lunch counters are segregated. The students have created a momentum, now embraced by the larger community, as black clergy urge their congregation to stay away from the downtown shopping district altogether.
It allowed for the whole community to be participants in the movement, because that's one of the things that we in the nonviolent world always teach, namely that in the nonviolent movement, everyone can be a participant. Children can participate, women can participate, men can participate, young people, old people. Everyone can do the work.
As the boycott takes hold, the sit-ins and arrests continue. The conflict becomes a seemingly permanent fact of life in the downtown shopping district. Picketing and boycotting provoke a racist backlash. But the counter-demonstrations backfire. Frightened white people begin avoiding the downtown area, unwittingly joining the boycott. A Fisk University economist calculates that some downtown stores have lost up to 40% of their business. As Easter approaches, the usual surge of spring buying never happens. Among blacks, the boycott is estimated at 98%.
That was a powerful message sent to the white community that, you know, it's one thing just to deal with these students on a Saturday-to-Saturday basis and lock them up and let them get bailed out and we'll try them and sentence them to $50 fines and that sort of thing. But it's another thing when you go down there and there's nobody on the street.
At Easter, the counters are still segregated, but the sit-ins have put civil rights on the national agenda as never before.
For the past several months, a new strategy to end racial segregation has been spreading through the South.
On Easter Sunday, NBC's Meet the Press looks at nonviolent resistance. The moderator suggests that boycotts might be better than sit-ins and arrests.
Dr. King, wouldn't you be on stronger grounds, though, if you refused to buy at those stores and if you called upon the white people of the country to follow you because of both your moral and your legal right not to buy?
I think, Mr. Spivak, sometimes it is necessary to dramatize an issue because many people are not aware of what's happening. And I think the sit-ins serve to dramatize the indignities and the injustices and the dissatisfaction of the Negro with the whole system of segregation.
We had a meeting planned for 6 a.m. I was in the dormitory getting dressed. And I heard this big boom. I soon learned that attorney Z. Alexander Luby's home had been bombed.
It, of course, was the effort of the enemy to scare us off. Violence has a very simple dynamic. I make you suffer more than I suffer. I make you suffer until you cry uncle and you surrender. That's what a war is. It's violence. The difference with nonviolence is we don't want to beat the opponent up. We don't think that does any good.
Luby and his wife are uninjured. But as Lawson has taught his students, violence can backfire. The bombing has shocked the city and given the students a strategic opportunity. They send a telegram to the mayor demanding a meeting, and they organize a silent march from the campus to City Hall. They begin with 1,500 marchers. Along the way, their number doubles. Mayor Ben West is waiting for them. West gets into an argument with a black minister, but then Diane Nash steps forward with some very direct questions.
I asked the mayor, first of all, Mayor West, do you feel that it's wrong to discriminate against a person solely on the basis of his race or color?
I tried as best I could to answer it frankly and honestly, that I could not agree that it was morally right for someone to sell them merchandise and refuse them service. And I had to answer it just exactly that way.
Nash goes on to ask the mayor whether he feels the lunch counters should be desegregated. He answers, yes.
It was the first major change in the attitudes of the city. Nashville began to desegregate its public institutions and its department stores that day. It took 3-4 years before theaters, restaurants, all public conveyances were desegregated. But with Ben West's declaration, no, it's not right, the process of change began.
The downtown retailers now tell the students privately they want to desegregate. The students devise a plan.
We suggested to them, which was a great relief to them, that there would be no announcement that the demonstrations had ended. There would be no announcements that black people were being served. No announcements, no press, no police.
Over a 2-week period, there would be what they call a trial basis, where couples would go to a certain restaurant and eat. And then there would be white observers, so there would be whites sitting nearby. It was all planned, and it worked very, very well without any incidents.
A movement that began in the basement of a small church in September has desegregated the downtown lunchrooms by spring. They go on to desegregate other restaurants and public facilities, showing how to remove business support for segregation by making it costly and controversial. It's a weapon that will prove decisive as the civil rights movement gains momentum.
We realized that we had the resources, both the spiritual resources as well as the psychological skills to make a difference in other places as well. We understood how to organize a community. We understood how to conduct a demonstration. We understood how to negotiate. And we understand how to deal with the media. We were warriors in that sense. We had been prepared. This was like a nonviolent academy, equivalent to West Point.
For the rest of the decade, they carry what they've learned farther south and across the country. Reflecting on what they had achieved, one of Nashville's students wrote, "You cannot wait for someone else to do it. You cannot wait for government to do it. You must make it happen through your own efforts and action and vision."
funding for this series was provided by Susan and Perry Lerner. Additional funding was provided by the Albert Einstein Institution, advancing the study of strategic nonviolent action in conflicts throughout the world. Elizabeth and John H. Van Merkenstein III. Abby and Alan Levy. And the Arthur Vining Davis Foundations.